From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. North Korea is threatening war. On today's Fresh Air, what does North Korea really want? What's at stake for the region and America? And how should we handle the crisis? We get two perspectives, from Selig Harrison, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer. Also today, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Stone Diaries by Carol Shields. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun has announced his retirement. The 85-year-old justice says it was time for him to step down.
I think part of it is the realization of the number of years. 85, that's an awful lot of years. And I don't want to be to reach a point where my senility level reaches unacceptable proportions. And I don't want to be asked to retire as Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. was, and to his great credit, moved in a minute.
Blackmun authored the controversial Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion in the United States. Kate Michaelman heads the National Abortion Rights Action League. She says Blackmun's successor should support abortion rights.
We urge President Clinton to nominate a justice who unequivocally recognizes that the Constitution protects our fundamental right to privacy, including women's rights to choose whether or not to have an abortion.
Early speculation indicates that Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt will be considered as candidates. A United Nations spokesman says Bosnian Serb forces have stopped attacking Garajda. The Bosnian Serbs have reportedly offered to negotiate an overall ceasefire with the Bosnian government. The offer has been accepted. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
UN spokesman Joe Sills told reporters that the Bosnian Serb attack on Garajde was halted at 1800 local time yesterday, or 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The commander of UN troops in Bosnia, Lieutenant General Sir Michael Rose, was to have visited Garajde today on a fact-finding mission. Sills said, however, that Rose did not continue with his mission and instead returned to Sarajevo after a Bosnian Serb leader offered to negotiate an overall ceasefire with Muslim forces. UN officials deny a wire service report that Rose was prevented from proceeding to Garajde by the Bosnian Serbs. They say that Rose instead decided to help get the ceasefire negotiations off the ground and dispatched a group of UN observers to go to Garajde instead. The ceasefire talks are scheduled to begin Thursday in Sarajevo. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Japan says its foreign minister is probably going to urge the U.S. trade representative to quickly resume stalled trade talks. Both officials will be in Morocco next week for a world trade meeting. The Japanese foreign minister is expected to express his concern over the U.S.'s revival of the Super 301 trade law. This permits the United States to impose stiff penalties on imports from a foreign country if trade talks with that country fail. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 11 points at 3,687. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is down a fraction at 750. This is NPR. English soccer officials have canceled an exhibition soccer game with Germany. They feared that neo-Nazis would disrupt the event. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The exhibition game, a warm-up for the World Cup, was scheduled for April 20th, Hitler's birthday, and was originally scheduled for Hamburg. But 3 months ago, Hamburg officials said they could not guarantee security. The authorities feared that German and British neo-Nazi groups marking Hitler's birthday would clash with anti-Nazi demonstrators. The contest venue was shifted to Berlin's Olympic Stadium, but in the eyes of the English football authorities, this increased security risks. The Olympic Stadium, built by Hitler for the 1936 Olympics, also has symbolic meaning for neo-Nazis. Gordon Taylor, chief executive of the English Players Union, welcomed the decision. He said, "It's a victory for common sense." German coach Bertie Vogts expressed disappointment the game was canceled, saying a few minority groups have turned Hitler's birthday into a memorable date again. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The Irish Republican Army has silenced its guns as it begins a 3-day ceasefire, but this is not drawing praise from Britain. Britain's chief official in Northern Ireland, Sir Patrick Mayhew, says the temporary ceasefire is no more than a threat that the IRA will renew its attacks in 3 days. Britain wants the IRA to permanently lay down its arms before Britain will negotiate an end to the conflict in Northern Ireland. The IRA says Great Britain should be more flexible. A published report says the Federal Reserve isn't likely to raise interest rates until financial markets steady themselves. The Washington Post reports that Fed officials will then consider whether to raise short-term interest rates again to keep inflation under control. The paper says despite the drop in the stock market and the gain in bonds, officials do not believe this is similar to the big stock crash that occurred in October 1987. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. North Korea has warned that the dispute over its nuclear program is pushing it to the brink of war. Last year, North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. It refused to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to inspect its nuclear power plants. This secrecy has led to suspicions that the North Koreans are using the plutonium from their nuclear power program to develop bombs. Last week, the United Nations Security Council warned the North Koreans that if they don't allow a full inspection of their nuclear facilities, they may soon face a trade embargo. On Tuesday, North Korea angrily rejected the Security Council's demands. What does North Korea want? What's at stake for that country, its region, and the United States? We'll hear two different points of view today. My first guest is Selig Harrison, Senior Associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been writing about North Korea since 1972, when he was the Washington Post's Tokyo bureau chief. He's visited North Korea 3 times and was most recently in South Korea last week. I asked him what North Korea is threatening to do.
North Korea is seeking to get diplomatic recognition and economic help from the United States, Japan, and South Korea, and it's using its nuclear weapons option as a bargaining lever to try to get those objectives achieved. They are not really threatening anything except that if they don't get a dialogue with the kind of concessions that they are seeking, they're going to go ahead and pursue the development of their nuclear program, which is essentially peaceful in its objectives, but which does involve the accumulation of plutonium that could be used for nuclear weapons, which of course is also true with respect to some other countries that reprocess plutonium, like Japan.
So North Korea wants to trade with the United States. They want economic recognition from the United States. But what would be in it for the United States to give that recognition to North Korea?
Well, North Korea is the last Stalinist regime in the world. And it's in the interest of the United States to draw it into contacts with the outside world that will lead to changes in that regime, gradual change of the kind that's been taking place in China. I think that the danger of a war in that part of the world would be progressively reduced as North Korea is drawn into trade and investment relationships with all of its neighbors and with the United States. And as certain policies that North Korea is now pursuing, such as the export of missiles to the Middle East, in order to earn foreign exchange, which it can't get through ordinary trade, that could be moderated if North Korea had a more balanced economic relationship with the rest of the world. And in general, the more it feels itself in a corner, surrounded, isolated by hostile countries, that aren't willing to cooperate with it economically, the more the danger that it will get leaders in North Korea who will do something irresponsible.
Well, what kind of dilemma does it create for the United States that North Korea is trying to pressure the United States into recognizing North Korea by the threat of basically nuclear war?
Well, I don't think they're threatening nuclear war. I think that's a misconception. North Korea has been trying to get the United States to pay some attention to it. and to move toward the normalization of relations before the nuclear issue arose. And basically, we have such a negative image of North Korea resulting from the early Cold War years, when their behavior and their terrorist activities have turned us off. So we've simply not responded. And they've turned to the nuclear issue as the best way to get our attention after other ways failed. And I can speak to that because I've been going in there since 1972. I was one of the first, first American to meet Kim Il-sung after the Korean War, and even in 1972, they saw that the United States was going to get friendly with Russia and China, that détente was beginning, and they figured, they wondered what was going to happen to them in that situation. And even going back that far, they've been making overtures which we have consistently rejected. This whole dispute is misunderstood because they've repeatedly offered to give up their nuclear program and to agree to the inspection that the United States wants if we will conduct a negotiation on these other issues that they're interested in. We say that we won't. On November 11th, for example, last year, they made a proposal for what they call a package solution, a formal proposal to comply fully with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to return to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and to reach other understandings with the U.S. regarding their nuclear program, if we would agree to their three major areas of interest: diplomatic recognition, economic help, and a pledge by the United States that we will not use nuclear weapons against them. Now, the American position is that they should do these things anyway, because they signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and therefore they're required to do them without any trade-off from our side. But there's a special angle to this story. When the North Koreans found early last year that we were not willing to negotiate with them, they said, all right, we'll leave the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That was, in a sense, moving the goalposts. It was playing the ultimate card. And the U.S. came back and said, no, no, please don't leave the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We will talk to you. But ever since then, we've been trying to get them to meet certain preconditions in the form of inspections before we would go ahead with the agreed discussions on diplomatic normalization and economic help. And the argument has been over who blinks first.
Do you think that North Korea is threatening nuclear war if the United States does not recognize it?
Oh, absolutely not. No, North Korea, if the United States does not negotiate with North Korea on diplomatic recognition and economic help, North Korea will simply proceed to develop its nuclear program for peaceful purposes, will acquire plutonium, which could give it the ability to make nuclear weapons, if it could master some of the technical obstacles it hasn't yet mastered. They have to learn how to make a trigger and other things. And so I think they're simply trying what the only weapon they have to get us to help them. And if we don't, I think they'll simply go back into their shell, and we will then be very worried. And the Japanese advocates of nuclear weapons in Japan will say, well, North Korea is trying to develop nuclear weapons. Maybe we should have nuclear weapons, too. In South Korea, the advocates of nuclear weapons will say the same thing. So the problem is not North Korea waging a nuclear war in the United States. The real reason why we should be concerned about North Korea's nuclear program is that it does encourage the nuclear hawks in Japan and South Korea. And a nuclear-armed Japan would really have a major impact on the world power situation. And I believe this whole nuclear issue is greatly exaggerated, the danger posed by North Korea's acquiring some plutonium. So do the Chinese. The Chinese are hesitant. They keep telling us to take it easy on this issue because they feel there's a big difference between accumulating a little bit of plutonium and being able to make nuclear weapons, which involves other technology that is needed.
Doesn't it look bad, though, for the United States to consider giving in to the kind of blackmail that North Korea is trying now?
That's the most difficult argument in this, that if we accede to North Korea's demands for concessions, we will be setting a dangerous precedent that might be used by Iran or other countries. The problem is that we have, at the present time, more than 9,000 nuclear weapons. And we are not ruling out the use of nuclear weapons in our military strategy. Indeed, Secretary Defense Perry just the other day made it clear that we're going to keep nuclear weapons as a part of our military strategy. As long as that's the case, we're fair game for blackmail. No self-respecting country in the world will accept a situation so unequal where we assert the right to have nuclear weapons, to use them first in a conventional war, and tell them they can't even have a little plutonium to give them the option of making nuclear weapons. In the case of Korea, we have not ruled out the first use of nuclear weapons against North Korea in the event of what we consider a conventional attack against South Korea.
I believe that North Korea has said that if the United States organizes sanctions against North Korea, North Korea will interpret that as an act of war. They will respond by calling for war?
Well,
clarify that for me.
Yes, North Korea. The North Korea has said that it would treat the invocation of economic sanctions by the UN as an act of war, which would give it the right, as far as it's concerned, to retaliate militarily against South Korea, against the American forces in South Korea. I think that the most dangerous thing is that once you get economic sanctions, then there are going to be demands for a naval blockade to enforce the sanctions, because ships could come in with oil, it's going to be very difficult to enforce the sanctions without a naval blockade. That is when I think North Korea might very well resort to some military retaliation against South Korea. But the North Koreans are not looking for a war. They don't have much petroleum these days because Russia and China aren't providing it. They have to pay cash on the barrelhead for it, and they don't have much foreign exchange available. The last thing they want is a war. But they certainly would feel that their national honor requires some kind of a response if they're subjected to a naval blockade. So that's the real danger. Sanctions as such might not trigger a military catastrophe in Korea. But once you go across once you get into military enforcement of the sanctions, then I think we're really asking for another Korean War.
What do you think the odds are that there will be another Korean War?
Well, I think that there is still hope that because of the feelings in China and in Japan and in South Korea, the desire to avoid another Korean War, the United States will gradually find a way to get back into dialogue with North Korea. I hope so. It's a 50-50 situation, but just yesterday, Prime Minister Hosokawa of Japan made a statement in conjunction with the South Korean foreign minister that appears to have urged the U.S. to get back into dialogue with North Korea. So I think Japan, South Korea, and China are going to force the United States to pursue a diplomatic option. But it's going to be a very dicey situation, and unless this is resolved by June, North Korea may take steps relating to its nuclear program, which would make it much harder to ever find out how much they have accumulated.
You just got back from South Korea. What were you looking for there?
Well, I was trying to find out how South Korea really felt about this issue. And I think that it's a country that's deeply divided between its own hawks and doves. And the government is not entirely free to do what it thinks best because it's under pressure from the right wing in South Korea to be tough toward North Korea and not let the U.S. go too far. The South Koreans go too far in making a deal with North Korea. South Koreans are, on the one hand, they certainly don't want a war. And therefore, they're very nervous when we appear to be pursuing provocative tactics toward North Korea. On the other hand, they don't want the United States to get too friendly with North Korea and give it too much help because of the traditional feelings of animosity between North Korea and South Korea left over from the Korean War after all these years.
My guest is Selig Harrison. He's a senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he's been focusing on North and South Korea since 1972 when he was Tokyo bureau chief for the Washington Post. We're going to take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about North Korea with Selig Harrison, senior associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You intend to go to North Korea sometime in May. Is it hard to get in?
Well, it's not a country you can just apply to, you just automatically get a visa for. In my case, I went there first in 1972. I've been back three times. They know that I try to write objectively about the situation. They don't like a lot of things I write. So we have their periods when they are very unhappy with what I'm writing and criticize me. But at the same time, they have to have want people to come into North Korea who will write about it in what they think is an objective way. And they do let Americans in and journalists in from time to time.
How difficult is life in North Korea under Kim Il-sung?
Well, it's a very tight ship. There is no freedom. Some people have compared it to the medieval church. Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times wrote an article in which he said North Korea is like the medieval church, where most people are true believers, just as in the Middle Ages people tolerated the persecution of heretics, so in North Korea people tolerate the what are obviously continuing human rights violations by Western standards. But the average person in North Korea has an assurance of housing and of medical care, and the country has made significant economic progress. Its problems, first of all, have to do with adequate food supplies at the present time. There's not very much meat in North Korea. The quality of their grain available to them is not very good at the present time. They don't have much petroleum coming in, so their buses and subways are not necessarily operating at full capacity. Some of the factories are even idle at the present time because of the cutoff of oil subsidies from China and Russia that they enjoyed during the Cold War, and the fact that they don't have foreign exchange. Because of their lack of foreign trade, to buy oil on the open market. So it's a hardship situation at the present time. Some of the picture of this hardship has been exaggerated. There's no famine. People aren't starving. People aren't revolting. But because they have to spend so much money on their military to defend themselves against what they see as the danger of a South Korean-American move to overthrow them, and create what happened in Germany and Korea, they spend five times more of their GNP on defense than South Korea does. The result is they starve their consumer goods industries. And that means that the average person in North Korea doesn't have the quality of consumer goods available to people all over the countries of Asia surrounding North Korea.
And what will you be looking for when you go to North Korea in May?
Well, I'll be looking. It's very hard for an outsider to find out much about the nuclear program. If the IAEA can't get access to some of these things, no outside scholar or journalist can. But what you can find out is what is happening in the leadership there, what kind of people, whether their leadership is really moving in a direction which is interested in contact and change, contact with the outside world, opening up to the outside world. All the indications from the outside are that process is moving fast, that the more moderate elements in North Korea are becoming more influential. When you go there and you talk to a variety of the leaders, you can get a sense of the internal situation there. And that helps you in evaluating what's going on and in deciding what you think our policy should be. One of the reasons I'm so clear in my own mind about what I think the United States should be doing, namely making a deal with North Korea, cooperating with them to help to open them up and normalize relations, is that I've been watching it in recent years, and I do see a big change internally in their attitude toward the outside world, and a real desire to join the outside world and to end this isolation that they've had for so many years during the Cold War.
In the meantime, the United States has sent Patriot missiles to South Korea.
Well, that was an understandable move on our part because it is a dicey situation, and the Patriot missile's a defensive weapon. And the North Koreans, although they've blustered about it a bit, are well aware that it's a defensive weapon, and they aren't really as upset about that as they might be about some of the other weapons we're talking about sending in, which have an offensive capability. So I think the Patriots were understandable from the point of view of the Clinton administration because to show Americans that we're not unconcerned about what might happen if there is another war there, what might happen to our forces there, and to show South Korea that we're committed to their defense if there is another war. But I think that if we get into an economic sanctions vote and then a naval blockade, that's when we begin to provoke North Korea, threaten North Korea militarily. If we send weapons to South Korea that are essentially offensive in character, if we go back to a resumption of these military exercises called Team Spirit, which we have been conducting every year with South Korea, which until very recently were kind of nuclear war games. You see, the United States had tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea until 1991. And it was the fact that they were there that led to the North Korean nuclear program in the first place. Now, the Team Spirit military exercises involve games that envisage the use of potential nuclear weapons in a crisis. That's the reason the North Koreans are so upset about them and don't want them. So I think that would be provocative. But the Patriot missiles themselves were an understandable American response.
One last question. Do you think that what we're seeing in North Korea is going to be happening more and more, that a small country under a dictatorship will be using plutonium or their nuclear industry as a bargaining chip?
I don't think there are too many cases like this. North Korea has been peculiarly isolated. We've been peculiarly unwilling to deal with them. Most of the other countries that are potential nuclear powers, we have much more normal, friendly relations with. And I really don't see the danger of a massive duplication of this problem. We've been willing in the Ukraine and in Kazakhstan to make it economically worthwhile for those countries to cooperate in destroying their nuclear weapons and in signing the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. There's no reason why we shouldn't do that in North Korea also. But I think that the only way to really make sure that we aren't subjected to pressures of this kind is to decide that nuclear weapons are not going to be a part of our military strategy in the future, and to move slowly and carefully, with an eye on what everybody else is doing, to gradually reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons in the world. As long as we are committed to the idea that we have a right to use them in our own military strategy, we certainly can't expect other countries not to want to have nuclear weapons of their own.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hope it's been helpful.
Selig Harrison is Senior Associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. In the second part of our show, we'll hear another point of view on North Korea from syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more on the crisis over North Korea. We talk with syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer. He maintains that North Korea already has a nuclear weapon and may be preparing to export nuclear arms. He says America must take action to prevent this. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Stone Diaries by Carol Shields. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says he's accepted the resignation of Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. Mr. Clinton says he'll select a nominee to succeed Blackmun as quickly as he can. He says the justice's shoes will be hard to fill, but the president has promised to seek an individual of great worth.
But I want to make sure that we have reviewed the appropriate options, and I will do that, and I think you'll... We'll have lots of time to talk about it in the days ahead.
Justice Blackmun says he'll miss the court, but he says he's leaving it in good hands.
It's been a great privilege to be on the federal bench for over 34 years, in 24 terms here, and to watch the country move along through those 24 years. It hasn't been much fun on most occasions, but it's a fantastic experience which few lawyers are privileged to have.
There's speculation that candidates to succeed Blackmun could include Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. U.S. and Canadian negotiators are discussing differences in farm trading again. Washington and Ottawa are trying to resolve a disagreement over the amount of Canadian wheat, sugar, and peanut products entering the United States. Canada is equally worried about American dairy and poultry products coming north of the border. Negotiators met 2 weeks ago in Canada without solving the dispute. The U.S. even threatened to raise tariffs on Canadian wheat, and Canada has prepared a list of U.S. products that could be hit with tariffs, too. The senior Canadian negotiator says that he thinks both countries can solve the problem. More Italian political infighting within the country's right wing could force new elections. The country just held elections a week ago, but the Italian right-wing alliance that won is fighting over who will become prime minister. The leading candidate appeared to be media magnate Silvio Berlusconi. His party received a lot of support in the election, but the leader of one of his main coalition allies now will not support him for the premiership. Berlusconi says he'll ask the Italian president to name him as prime minister anyway. A business group says drug testing by top U.S. companies is at a record high. The American Management Association says its survey for 1993 finds 87% of leading corporations test their workers, job applicants, or both for drug use. That's up from 22% in 1987 when the first annual survey was taken. The report also finds that firms that combine testing with drug education programs had relatively fewer drug problems than companies that did not offer these programs. Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street. The Dow was up more than 4 points to end the day at 3,679. This is NPR. By a federal judge's order, voters in one Maryland county will be able to cast as many as 5 votes for one candidate in coming county commission elections. The cumulative voting is thought to give black candidates a better chance of being elected to the 5-member county board, which is now all white and elected at large. Cumulative voting was one of the ideas backed by Lonnie Guinier and at the center of the controversy that led President Clinton to pull back her nomination to head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division last year. Environmental activists in Ukraine are demanding that the Chernobyl nuclear power plant be closed. They also want President Leonid Kravchuk to withdraw a decree to speed up the opening of 5 nuclear reactors. Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
The call for the closure of the Chernobyl reactor, which produced the world's worst nuclear accident 8 years ago this month, comes a week after the International Atomic Energy Agency issued a report describing the plant as unsafe. Ukrainian nuclear officials downplay the report, saying that the world had promised to provide safe technology for the plant. But environmentalists, as well as the ministers of health and environment, have also called for the suspension of a recent presidential decree to expand the nuclear power industry. The authorities' move back toward nuclear power is intended to reduce Ukraine's costly energy imports from Russia. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
The State Department is condemning Iraqi attacks against United Nations personnel and journalists in northern Iraq. A spokesman suggested the Iraqi government could be responsible. Baghdad says the charge is absurd. The United Nations says it has reports that Iraq is offering a bounty for anyone who murders UN and other international relief workers. The most recent attack came on April 3rd, when a German reporter was murdered. She and her Iraqi bodyguard were shot to death, apparently at very close range. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The North Koreans have refused to let the International Atomic Energy Agency inspect their nuclear facilities. This has reinforced suspicions that the North Koreans are developing or have developed a nuclear weapon. The UN has warned of a possible trade embargo if North Korea doesn't cooperate. North Korea has said it would interpret economic sanctions as an act of war. In the first part of our show, Selig Harrison said the North Koreans are playing the nuclear card to gain diplomatic recognition from the United States. Harrison says we should negotiate with them. Charles Krauthammer says we've already made too many concessions. Krauthammer is a syndicated columnist and an essayist for Time magazine. I asked him what he thinks North Korea really wants.
I think they want the bomb.
And what do you think that's what they really want?
Well, if you were a North Korean and you have the history that they have of an invasion in 1950 of the South Korea and ultimately having to settle for a stalemate, seeing the power that the bomb brings to other countries, if you had no economy as they do, they have no economy, they have really no prospects in the future. The bomb is their reach for power, for respect, for attention. And it also, for them, would be an enormous source of hard currency. They produce nothing that the world wants. This would be something that a lot of countries with a lot of cash want. It would be their greatest export. In fact, today, the CIA tells me, the major hard currency earner for North Korea are ballistic missiles. So these are people who want the bomb for power and for commerce.
So you think they'd be selling plutonium to other countries or actual bombs?
Well, I mean, I don't know about the details of their transactions. They would be in a position to sell both. But I'm sure that if they were a buyer with the correct anti-American ideology and the right cash, of which there are several countries, they'd be in a position to sell. They have had no hesitation in selling deadly ballistic missiles to countries extremely unfriendly to us.
What do you make of the argument that what North Korea really wants is to use plutonium and nuclear weapons as a bargaining chip in order to normalize relations with the United States and open up trade?
I used to be a psychiatrist. We would call that projection. Projecting on somebody else one's own wishes and ideas. That's a Western idea. Now, what's important in life is getting diplomatic recognition and getting a little bit of foreign aid and some trade and all the things that a bourgeois society values. Those are not the values of Kim Il-sung. And to pretend that it is, I think, is really terrible wishful thinking. There's also no evidence whatsoever that that's true. The North Koreans have been given by the Clinton administration every chance, every 3 weeks, we return after being slapped in the face and say, look, what we think is that you really want all these little goodies. Here they are. All you have to do is allow inspections, and they slap us in the face again. There's not an iota of evidence that that's what they really want. They've had every opportunity to get it, and they have rejected it. All the evidence for the last year is that what they want is the bomb. They would also like to have the other goodies on the side by threats and promises which in the end they break, but that they'd be willing to give up the bomb for that, there's not an iota of evidence.
What are the goodies you're referring to?
Well, with diplomatic recognition, for example, when they first announced last year that they were withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we offered them to get them to induce them to suspend that decision. We offered them high-level meetings with the United States, something which they have not had in 40 years. They got that for free, because in the end, they didn't allow the kinds of inspections that we had wanted. Number two, they have always wanted us to cancel or suspend our military exercises with South Korea. We dangled that in front of them last year and said, look, if you give up the bomb, we'll cancel our maneuvers. Well, they haven't given it up. And in fact, thinking that they had, we had announced a suspension of Team Spirit. That's the name of the exercise of last year. So they pocketed that. We have also offered them, if they they cooperate with international inspections, aid and official diplomatic recognition. And so far, they've had all of these offers, and they have, in return, given us less than nothing. They have given us, they were required to allow inspections of undeclared sites. That's now off the table. They offered, they said they were offering last year to allow us to inspect 7 declared sites, and as you know, they reneged on that just last month. So they have proceeded with their program. They have pocketed a few of the goodies that we have offered them, and we have received nothing in return.
I just want to clarify something. You said that we had announced suspension of Team Spirit. Did the administration say that we will go forward with some of the military exercises?
It's been very interesting how cagey and delicate we have been about that. We have refused to announce a date for the resumption of Team Spirit, which would be a way of definitively saying that they're back. We have simply said we're going to resume it, but we've been very cagey in saying, well, we and the South the Koreans are still discussing it, which is a way of sending a signal to North Korea that, you know, if you play ball with us a little bit more, we won't be pushing on this issue.
Now that the Cold War is over, do you think it might be in the best interest of the United States to try to normalize relations with North Korea?
Well, only if they go non-nuclear. I think it would be worth it as a trade, but there's no evidence that they would accept that trade.
But haven't they offered to give up the nuclear program in return for economic recognition and trade?
Well, no, they haven't. And in fact, we learned last week that during this whole year of negotiations, when we assumed that was so, they have been increasing their capacity to separate plutonium and to produce the bomb. Now, if you were really going to use this bomb program only as a bargaining chip to get all the goodies that others have said that that's all they want, why would you at the same time be expanding the program? They're developing 2 new reactors, which by 1996 they will give them the capacity to produce 30 bombs a year, not 1 or 2, but 30, a veritable bomb factory. Now, why would all that material, all that effort, all that financial resources be going into this program if all they wanted to do was to bargain it away?
North Korea has said it would interpret economic sanctions against it as an act of war. What do you think North Korea is threatening to do in the near future?
Well, it's threatening to use its ostensible conventional superiority and its ability to probably wreck Seoul, the capital of South Korea. It's using that threat to completely stymie any American attempt to stop them from getting the bomb. And by threatening us that anything that we do, even short of war, I mean, short of a military strike, just sanctions, would be a cause of war, they are, as of now, successfully preventing us from doing anything significant to stop them from getting the bomb.
If, you know, North Korea is threatening war, what do you have any sense of what they would do if they declared war?
Well, there are many things that they can do, first of all, short of war. This is a regime that has ruthlessly and repeatedly used the most egregious kind of terrorism to advance its aims. It blew up a South Korean airliner as a way to try to jeopardize the 88 Olympics. But the worst scenario is that their million-man army, which is poised on the DMZ, on the border, comes over the border, overwhelms the American and South Korean defenders, and is able to reach and wreck Seoul, which is only 35 miles away.
If you're just joining us, my guest is syndicated columnist and Time magazine essayist Charles Krauthammer. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer is my guest. We're talking about North Korea. How close do you think North Korea is to actually having an atom bomb?
According to the CIA, it already has it. Has one, probably two. And the administration position today, well, it used to be. President Clinton said last year, we will not allow the North Koreans to develop the bomb. Well, now we've backed off that. This is a president who backs off everything in foreign policy. He's backed off that, and our position is, okay, they can have the one or the two that they have now, but we're going to be very strong and very firm in not allowing them to develop anymore. Well, let's see if they can hold that line now.
I thought the CIA had said that North Korea has enough plutonium for one or two bombs, but that wouldn't mean they have the technology for the bomb.
Well, nobody knows if the bomb has been put together, but we assume that they have the plutonium, and we assume that they have the know-how to put it together.
Sum up for us what you would recommend the Clinton administration do.
Well, I think that we wasted a year, and we showed a tremendous amount of weakness. And I'm not sure at this point that there's any way to convince the Koreans that we are serious in the way that that the Bush administration had demonstrated years ago that we would be serious about the invasion of Kuwait. We have repeated so many times that our highest priority is to prevent a war on the Korean Peninsula that I think that the North Koreans have the impression that we will do in the end nothing to stop them. That said, I think it's absolutely imperative that we go immediately to economic sanctions. We've given the North Koreans 6 weeks, another 6 weeks, after already a year of being strung along. We've given them another 6 weeks to shape up on these inspections. There's little prospect that they will. It's very important for us to work with the Chinese and to say to them that the stopping of the North Korean program is the most important priority that we have in all of East Asia. And if they want our relations to remain good with us, they're going to have to at least abstain at the UN and allow a sanctions resolution to pass. Otherwise, they'll be jeopardizing their trade relations with us, which are very important to the Chinese. And lastly, we have to beef up our forces in South Korea. We don't want a war. We certainly would not start a war. But as we learned in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, the more forces that we have in place, the less risk we have in the end. If there is an invasion, we only have 37,000 troops. They are extremely exposed. We could have tremendously high casualties. I think we have to start a program reinforcing our troops in the South.
If we do enact economic sanctions against North Korea, is it possible that China would actually be able to get goods across the border since China and North Korea share a border? And would that actually strengthen ties between North Korea and China?
Well, the strengthening of ties isn't that important. The question is whether China would sustain the North Koreans enough to vitiate the effects of sanctions.
Well, what do you think?
It's possible. It's very possible. China supplies 3/4 of North Korea's oil. If the other quarter is cut off from the rest of the world and the Chinese make it up, then our sanctions are worthless, which is precisely why we should be making extremely clear to the Chinese that cooperation on this issue is the single most important issue in U.S.-Chinese relations. Unfortunately, we have made human rights in China the paramount issue. I'm not against making it an issue. I think it's very important. But at this particular junction in history, where the North Korean bomb is about to come onto the scene, I think it's irresponsible not to make a difficult but very important choice, and that is to say to the Chinese, we need and want and demand your cooperation on North Korea. We don't want you to make up for whatever is going to be cut off by the rest of the world.
After all the problems with military intervention in Somalia and all of the question marks that still remain about our role in Bosnia, would you want to see the United States become more militarily involved in Korea?
Well, I think you really have to draw a distinction. You can't just say I'm for military involvement in general or I'm for non-military involvement in general. It makes no sense. It's sort of a mindless policy. The United States ought to take military risks where our national interests are at stake and where very important threats are involved. North Korea is such a place. In Somalia, we had zero national interest. We had a humanitarian interest. It was kind of like an earthquake rescue, but it had nothing at all to do with American national interest. And that's why, in the end, there was no public support when the price in American lives was high. I have a similar perspective on Bosnia, where I think our national interest is rather minimal. We can argue about that, and that, I think, also is a shared perception by Americans, and that's why we haven't been involved. But non-proliferation has been declared by people on the left, on the right, by Democrats and Republicans, by Clinton, everybody, as the major threat to the United States and its friends over the next decade or two. The worst threat, I mean, the only real threat to the safety and the lives of the people living in New York or Los Angeles or Philadelphia or anywhere is of a rogue state or a terrorist group getting its hands on the bomb. And if non-proliferation is not an important enough issue to make a stand on, then there's no issue in the world.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Charles Krauthammer is a syndicated columnist and an essayist for Time magazine. This is Fresh Air. Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun announced today that he'll be stepping down from the court. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg about Justice Blackmun's announcement today. He and President Clinton appeared before reporters to say that he will be retiring. We'll hear about some of his most important decisions and contributions to the court. He wrote the Roe v. Wade decision on abortion. We'll also be hearing from two Harvard law professors who don't agree about all that many things. Professors Fried and Tribe will discuss the contributions of Harry Blackmun, including a very interesting decision and body of law on commercial speech. Also, modeling music, a new synthesizer that uses mathematical formulas.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A novel by Carol Shields called The Stone Diaries traces the 80-some-odd years in the life of a woman named Daisy Stone Goodwill. But critic Maureen Corrigan says that plot summary does about as much justice to The Stone Diaries as describing Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure as the story of a young man who can't get into the college of his choice.
I'm going to let you in on a little book reviewer's trick. Sometimes when I get really absorbed in a story, I don't take notes. Instead, what I do is fold down pages of the book where the dialogue is especially witty, the character's behavior startling, or the descriptive passages so dead-on perceptive, it's like they make me see the world for the first time. When I reached the end of The Stone Diaries, I had folded down so many pages, my advance proof copy was spronging open like a paperback slinky. Probably the most remarkable thing that ever happens to our heroine, Daisy Stone Goodwill, is her birth in rural Manitoba in 1905. Though Daisy is barely conscious for the event, her role here as omniscient first-person narrator grants her magical powers of observation. Her story begins with what she calls a scene of blood and ignorance. This is the afternoon her mother, an enormously fat woman named Mercy Stone, was surprised by pains she mistook for terrible indigestion. When Daisy's cheerful young father, Kyler Goodwill, arrives home hours later from his job in a nearby limestone quarry, this is what greets him. A scene of chaos, his house with its unanticipated and unbearable human crowding, a strange, sharp scent rising to his nostrils, and a high, rhythmic cry of lamentation spiraling upward and joining the derangement of linen and of air, at the center of which lies his wife, on the blood-drenched kitchen couch, its gathered cretonne cover, my mother, her mountainous body stilled. Eclampsia, Dr. Spears says solemnly, pulling a sheet, no, not a sheet, but a tablecloth, up over her face. The infant Daisy is left in the care of a neighbor woman and then reclaimed by her father when she's 11. Daisy and her father move to Bloomington, Indiana, where during the roaring 20s, he becomes a captain of industry and she becomes a young widow. She later marries for a second time. The groom is her foster uncle. Together they have three children, and Daisy mutates into a model 1950s housewife. Her old age in Florida drags on a long time. She and her elderly girlfriends celebrate each other's birthdays with this rueful toast. Well, here's to another year, and let's hope it's above ground. When Daisy does finally die, a strange, unsentimental narrator steps in to encapsulate her life in a series of lists. A list of the illnesses she suffered, a list of the books she read, a list of things that, due to lack of courage or opportunity, she never experienced, like oil painting, oral sex, and the city of Madrid. Doesn't exactly sound like an action-packed plot, does it? But the power of Shield's story is cumulative. In lustrous, compassionate language, she slowly builds up the small details of her characters' lives until you realize they've become dramatically different people. Shields makes you appreciate the long-term awesomeness of mundane changes. Reading The Stone Diaries is like watching a fast-forward, God's-eye-view movie of how a tiny, prehistoric streamlet carved out the Grand Canyon.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Stone Diaries by Carol Shields. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Audrey Voblitis, and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mexico is in turmoil following a rebel uprising in Chiapas and the assassination of the ruling party's presidential candidate. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with one of the country's most celebrated writers, Carlos Fuentes. I'm Terry Grosso, hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.